Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, today joined by Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you very much, Nick, and glad to see you back. We missed you last week, and but glad you're back in the land of the living.
Thank you, thank you. It's very good to be back in the land of the living. I'm still not 100% amongst the living,
We
but
can
with
hear
any luck, the
that.
next few days I will be. I've also got Mr. Terence Corrigan with us here today. Terence, how are you doing?
I'm okay, Nicholas. Probably better than you are.
I suspect so. Yes, I recommend that everyone who has the opportunity to avoid getting this particular flu that's going around does so because it is, oh, it's bad. Anyway, let us dive into the news of today. So I'm sad I missed the somewhat amusing and exciting departure of Floyd Shivambu from the ANC last week. But this week, it opens with an interesting look into what the ANC is kind of going through internally. It's quite kind of a to paraphrase Douglas Adams, a long dark tea time of the soul, a little bit it seems. ANC Chair Panyaza Lesufi has told the Provincial Executive Committee of the ANC that the party is, quote, a sinking ship. He said that instead of looking at saving the sinking ship, ANC leaders were instead concerned about leadership battles, forgetting whoever takes over will inherit a party that will be out of power. He said, what has transpired has given the ANC a last chance. It is how the ANC responds to it that will determine whether indeed we can still have a majority party in our country. My political input to the Provincial Executive Committee is very simple. The ship is sinking. The ship is sinking. The problem is instead of identifying why the ship is sinking so that we can stop it from sinking, we are squabbling over who must own the ship, and whoever can own that ship, unfortunately, will inherit a sinking ship. It will be meaningless. Our ability not to listen to the purpose of learning and changing the situation, but to listen, to argue, differ, to shout, has plunged us to where we are, and that particular ship, we need to revisit that. He basically said that the ANC can't continue on in business as per usual. He also talked about what he said were the benefits of the government of national unity. And one of them, he said, was that he believed that it truly was uniting South Africans. Lesufi said, we are drifting apart as South Africans, to be quite frank. White people were voting for white parties. Black people were voting for black parties. Indians were voting for Indian parties. So to have everyone under one roof, I think it also brings South Africans generally together. So I think our negotiators did well. I will forever cherish that. It's just unfortunate that in our province didn't go that route, but we still have an organization that can still engage and assist us. So Terence, let me start with you here. I think that Lesufi, of course, is correct to point out that the ANC is definitely an organization in crisis. That it's an organization that needs to change the way it's doing things if it wants to retain political relevance. But then when it comes to talking about his own province's failure to negotiate a deal, he just sort of hand waves it away. It's like, oh, well, oops, had these things happen. Is this a case of Lesufi not taking his own advice?
This is a case of sort of compete, being able to believe two things at once. He's quite correct that that the ship is sinking as it always would. The ANC was from the 1990s implausible. It managed to keep itself together through a combination of sort of quasi-ideological scaremongering and increasingly just patronage. That was always a glue that was going to dry and flake off. An abysmal interest in actual governance, in actual administration. So yeah, we are where we are. The ANC is finally having to pay the butcher's bill on it, it needs to decide what it wants to do. It still calls itself a liberation movement, although I have seen a couple of its documents, tentatively refer to itself as having the hallmarks of a political party. Wow. On pretty much every substantive issue that he raised there, driving people apart, I mean, that has been Premier Lesufi's modus operandi. He's been a notorious race hustler. I'd say probably one of the most aggressive in his party, including showing up at kindergartens to remonstrate about cupcakes without finding out what was actually happening. And then is tweeting out of Django Unchained. The MEC is dealing with the racists. They hadn't been establishing any racism existed, but I mean that. You know, it was just narrative. That was the type of politics he engaged in. I don't think it's that in itself has ever been particularly popular with anyone. But the brand carried him so far. And then he simply he oversaw the provincial machine that refused to engage meaningfully with the DA. I think that's because he. As he once said, they will combat it wherever it rears its ugly head, and I don't think he's been able to get past that. So no, the ship is going down, and I don't know. He at least recognizes that, but his solution is I don't know. Seems to be not to get into a lifeboat, but to rip bigger holes in it, maybe. I'm not sure what metaphor you'd use there, actually. Interesting. Michael, I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with your essential thesis. The metaphor, I think we'd probably need to confer on and work on a bit. It requires a bit of refinement, because you've got to express something quite sort of subtle, actually. As you said, a party, powerful figure in a party is prepared to see two realities at the same time and somehow combine them to make some sort of, to his ear, some sort of sense. And I think that's long been a problem. I like the fact that you went right the way back to the 1990s, because I think there was a great deal of sentiment around the emergence of the ANC as a government, this kind of post-liberation movement in government, that tended to obscure or overlook all the things that ought to be in red lights right from the word go, and of course became very prominent with corruption, the arms deal, late 1990s. I will never forget figures like Dalai Omar, then Justice Minister, appearing outside the gates of Polesmer when Tony Yengeni was sent in. He was very clearly the fall guy. He was going to, and they were all there. I think Ibrahim Rasool was there, other senior ANC people, and you simply don't get away with those kinds of gestures without paying the kind of cost that the ANC is now having to confront. So there's this kind of fairly long-standing condition of wishful thinking and kind of delusional thinking. It's partly also something that you've written about a great deal, Terence. It's its own notion of its historical mission, that it has this by right mission to rule, because it reflects the will of the people, the will of the nation, and so on. And all of this has now suddenly been called into doubt by the balls and numbers at the ballot box, which is exactly where things ought to happen most effectively, as they always do in history, where there's a democracy. And I thought the other point that worth making is, we are in a very different situation, and it's not simply that, as Le Soufi says, the South Africans are united or uniting. I think we're much more burdened way of seeing it is that South Africans are now actually quite impatient. They now recognize what can actually be done. I think there's a greater sense of popular agency in directing affairs, and they want to see the governments and see senior politicians doing the real stuff, not just talking about it, not talking about saving the ANC. That's not anybody's business except the ANC's. It's certainly not going to serve the public interest. What's going to serve the public interest is identifying what needs to be done and getting down and doing it. So I think that's certainly that's this kind of spirit that I think has been unleashed with this kind of realigned political terrain. That's a bad mix of metaphors, but the kind of realignment in politics.
If I could, If I can just jump in there, there's one point I'd like to make. The sense of unreality in what he's saying is encapsulated by that black white people vote for white parties, black people vote for black parties, Indian people voted for Indian parties. First of all, is there an Indian party in South Africa? And there was the Minority Front, but they didn't even contest. So I think we can just write it off as empirically absent. Secondly, you know, I imagine when he says white parties, he kind of means the DA, but minority of his votes came from white people.
Mm-hmm.
I think sadly the ANC is probably the example of the party that has retreated furthest into its kind of racial lager. For all of its sins in the 1990s, even into the Mbeki era, it was able to count on a fairly broad mix of people, including white suburbanites. And I remember speaking to my late brother, talking about friends of his who had sort of come of age in the 80s, the kind of your sort of NUSAS, UDF lefties, firm ANC in 1994, firm ANC in 1999, reluctant ANC in 2004, sort of cope in 2009, and finally holding their nose and doing DA in 2014. That said less about racial polarization than about the ability to alienate parts of its constituency, in part because of the kind of nativist sentiments that it decided to starting under Mbeki and then kind of full throttle under Zuma.
Yeah.
So here's another interesting sort of piece I want to add to this discussion. And this comes from Momoloko Kubayi, who's a sort of, I guess, one of the few rising stars of the ANC. She's been a minister, and I'm not actually sure if she's in the current cabinet, but she is the head of the ANC's Economic Transformation Committee. And she wrote a defense of the government of national unity. However, she wrote it from this is like from like a, essentially a Soviet perspective. She says that the decision of the ANC to form the government of national unity should be viewed alongside sort of Mao Zedong's temporary alliance with the nationalists against the Japanese in World War II, or Lenin's new economic policy, where he sort of laid off the communism for a bit in the 1920s to let the Soviet Union recover a bit before they implemented full communism. And it's filled with, sort of glowing quotes from Mao Zedong about this, as well as from Lenin. And I'm not gonna read all those because too much attention has been given to those guys over the many decades that they've been quoted, but I think this kind of sums up the sort of the lack of reality in the ANC sort of perspective here. Is that on one hand, this is someone who's defending the government of national unity, which for the ANC's sake is probably a very important and sensible thing to do. And yet she's doing it in terms that presumably are aimed at an ANC audience who is still living in the 1970s. This is all part of advancing the National Democratic Revolution. We must retreat in order to advance. By entering into a GNU agreement, she says, the ANC has not forgotten its political tasks to renew, strengthen itself, and unite all progressive forces within the broad liberation movement to continue advancing the National Democratic Revolution. I'm not really sure how one advances the National Democratic Revolution and also shares some sort of political power. And I suspect a lot of what she seems to be suggesting here is the way forward for the ANC is something like what I talked about in a column I wrote, 2 weeks ago, about how the ANC and DA are now sort of entwined together in a political dance of death. But Michael, what do you make of this piece? It's quite curious.
Yeah, I was just... I mean, just this with one paragraph is just worth repeating, that the DA has organized and positioned itself historically as a champion of the interests of the white minority, especially capital, is an inescapable truism. That is to say, the distrust that still permeates within the ranks of the liberation movement about the intentions of the DA is not unfounded. So forgive the slightly ungrammatical phrasing there. I mean, this tells you all you need to know about somebody who is still very much stuck in an ideological rut, just cannot actually examine conditions on the ground as they actually are. And therefore, you know, the rhetoric is kind of achingly anachronistic and pointless. It's not speaking really to anybody other than those few, presumably still there, sort of diehard theorists in the ANC who cleave to this, you know, all these very outdated, very 1960s notions. It's a kind of faux revolutionary rhetoric, isn't it? I mean, it isn't really, it's not even stirring anymore. You know,
it hasn't really crossed with everything that's happened since 1989, has it?
It's just, you know, it's tired, exhausted phrasing. Yeah. So there we go. I mean,
it's where sad. Every day is Easter 1962.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's what this reads like. And it's you know, This is the problem that the ANC has, and the person who wrote this is actually one of the rising intellectual stars in the ANC. So, you know, the party really has to come to grips with reality if it wants to survive, is that it was the National Democratic Revolution that led it to this place. Its governance failures are in many ways a direct result of the National Democratic Revolution. You can say the objectives, the sort of top-level objectives of the National Democratic Revolution of a, you know, free, equal, peaceful, prosperous society are all wonderful. But if the path that, you know, you're taking to get there is leading you further away from it, then you really should think about whether this actually is what you should be doing. Many left-wing political parties after 1989 did do that. Apparently not the ANC.
Well, you know, look, actually, I'll go one further. So there were communist parties in places like Italy and France that pretty much realized this in the 1950s, that, maybe, you know, kulakizing and, you know, killing people by the hundreds of thousands wasn't a great idea, especially when you can do some funny things with votes. In fact, they became quite influential. But no, the I think that unfortunately the ANC does remain hidebound by its ideology. Although I will say, in partial defense, this isn't the first time we've seen stuff like this. Thabo Mbeki, for instance, used to write these turgid documents with lots of Marxist phraseology. And I remember Jeremy Cronin saying that he explained gear in a Marxist metaphysics. Which was quite an interesting way to put it. But for me, this is about, well, once again, there's an air of unreality that I think that what is really kind of, what is both concerning but also farcical, is that there is something that is profoundly anti-pluralistic about this. And I use that word advisedly. The ANC, you know, would probably genuinely believes in the notion of democracy as in the will of the people, which it believes it embodies, and therefore is kind of entitled to be elected, and to its great credit, did accept the verdict of an adverse election. But the sense that there are equal and legitimate opponents within the within the country, that is singularly lacking from this. The idea that you can sort of draw a line between Lenin and Mao, people who weren't famously hospitable to their opponents, even if their opponents were communists themselves, just like got them in the wrong faction. I seem to remember that there was before he took power in Russia, a fellow Russian exile said at a conference that Lenin is not a good man. I could be wrong about that, but I think he got it right. We need to, you know, it's it's about doing what Brian Pottinger just said, you know, moving to a higher level of modernity, and just sort of understanding that we now live in a world that is vastly different from that, and those grand narratives don't make a great deal of sense anymore, if ever they did.
Indeed. Okay, let's move on a little bit to related but not quite the same thing. And you know, we recently had some relatively bad unemployment news, the official unemployment rate ticking up slightly once again, showing that for all the good happy talk that's been going on, the problems in the country with our economy are still very, very real. And we've had some interesting comments made by the governor of the Reserve Bank, Lesego Kanyako, who said that monetary policy can't fix the economy, that there are limits to sort of how much, you know, controlling interest rates can actually deal with the underlying problems that we have. He went on to say, what really matters for inequality is economic growth, job creation, and productivity growth. These outcomes occur when markets function effectively, when the costs of economic activity are clear and stable, and when the essential public services and network industries work to reduce the cost of economic activity. He said, in the wake of the pandemic, South Africa's homegrown supply constraints continue to drive up inflation, and the bank's flexible inflation targeting framework helps us to see through temporary inflation effects, but not the permanent ones. The upshot is that if we want better growth and less inequality, significant improvement in our supply environments are necessary. Michael, you also wrote on this topic, basically, when ANC senior leader David Makura said that capital needs to come to the party to rescue the country's economy. And you had some thoughts on that. Michael, why don't you share this with us?
So this is my column in Business Day this morning. And in fact, I drew very considerably on two colleagues who have a great deal more economic insight than I do. But just to dwell a little bit on what David Makura said, he said that, I'm just going to quote his line, people are worried about their lives and the lives of their children. We all want to live a better life. You and I are worried about the same thing. The transformation of the economy is central to creating a more inclusive society. This is why capital must come to the party. So, you know, we can all actually agree on those the basic precepts, except or the very basic insights, except the last one. And the reason for that is, as I say, the one virtue of capital is perhaps that it does actually have a cold heart. It's not a question of patriotism that the people invest. They're not stimulated by warm feelings about a country. They're stimulated by a very complex blend of interests, self-interest, but mutual interests. And if those aren't there, capital doesn't come. But what those things indicate is a society that, as Terence has indicated, is geared to a kind of modern approach to life. It's not hide bound. It's not ideologically driven. It's open to new ideas. It's prepared to protect property rights. It acknowledges people as people. It does all these things. It rewards merit, and it certainly encourages investment on the grounds of providing a safe place for people to prosper, to have agency, and to live this optimistic life that is essentially what all people really want. It's the only route to the better life that's been promised in South Africa since 1994. But to have those things, you need to have a firm, solid, dependable policy environment that excludes such things as threats to property rights, NHI, minimum wage, undue labor regulation that just makes it harder for people to find work, get work, employ people. And so those are all the things that are stopping capital from coming to the party. And the party is not this, you know, circle in the forest where we all have warm-hearted feelings and we sit down and congratulate one another on being patriotic South Africans. Capital is simply an instrument that is available to people to use very well or not at all to change their lives and change the society they live in. And ours is a society that has massive unemployment, lots of dysfunction. In order to fix all these things, we need more capital. We need to provide the conditions in which capital feels safe to come here, to people to invest, and for us to then use the opportunities that flow. So that's really, really a key thing there. And just one little, I mean, one of the, I quoted our Daily Friend colleague, Jonathan Katzenellenbogen, but also our CEO, Dr. John Endres, who wrote actually also on the Daily Friend last week. He made this point that, you know, we can look at the investor confidence and sort of feel good about this. This is a good sign post the election, post the establishment of the GNU, things are getting better. But the point he makes is a much more meaningful number is the rate of gross fixed capital formation, which measures how much money gets spent on things like factories, bridges, heavy machinery, power plants, roads and rail, all the things that make the physical economy tick. And the point about this is, in the case of the private sector, which accounts for about two-thirds of gross fixed capital formation, it is because investors distrust the SA investment environment too much that they are not willing to place their money in assets which cannot easily be moved. So it's, you know, the idea of fixed assets, this literally is what it means. These are things that can't easily be moved, and they're only going to happen if people feel that the policy environment is secure and that the country is facing the front, modernizing, and really does know what kind of policies it needs to enact.
Yes, I also think that people put too much stock, firstly, in the sort of daily fluctuations of the markets themselves. You know, they say, well, you know, the JSE is up by 10% or something. This means that what the government is doing economically is good. Well, not necessarily, because the decisions that go into trading there are based off of a huge range of things, including people gambling, essentially taking a bet that this is a sign that something good will happen. It's not actually evidence that something good or bad has happened. It's just what people perceive it to be, which is not always the same thing. They're more, you know, sort of stock traders can be wrong. That's why you actually need very, you need concrete changes if you're going to see anything in the long term. And so I think it's very important that, you know, the kind of happy talk by business and stuff, even if it's, I think, got a little bit more foundation than it did, let's say, a year ago, you know, until the policies actually change, it can't take you to the end of the road. Terence, what do you make of this?
Yeah. What strikes me is this term capital. I remember reading something when I was a student, you know, many decades.
It's a big, dark, hegemonic cloud roves around the landscape.
The particular source that I remember reading was that capital is a monstrous, unprincipled thing. And I think, you know, capital effectively refers to resources. You know, people behind capital who make those decisions may be, you know, can be softies, or they may be monstrous, unprincipled beasts or whatever, but they're actual, you know, human beings. And they're going to, you know, they're going to operate off incentives and be dissuaded by disincentives. But yeah, you know, fundamentally, there are decisions being made, and there are very good reasons why capital has not come to the party. I would divert very slightly from Michael said. You know, I don't think that there is necessarily a firm mix of policies that will guarantee anything. But I think that in aggregate, there has to be an opportunity. Mm. There are large opportunities in South Africa, but you know, in many respects, the costs of accessing them are prohibitive. Labor in a country like Sweden, for instance, is exponentially more expensive than it is here, but it is productive. You have a whole infrastructure that makes it easy to move things. And so it is, you know, for someone interested in doing XYZ in that particular market, and it will make sense. You know, in South Africa, you know, we somehow want We somehow want Scandinavian prices with combined with German labor pre or Scandinavian wages combined with German with German labor protections and Chinese productivity, while we have Congolese infrastructure. These things don't, come together because we've decreed it.
No.
Right, exactly. And that's part of this whole ideological bind of refusing to recognize where the country actually is in the world and who it's competing with.
Facts
It's sort of
are
this,
stubborn things.
indeed, it's a sort of, 19, I don't know what to call it, 1950s, 1930s autarkic view that we're this little sort of island and we need to reorganize capital in the correct way to increase our proletariat's productivity. But it's just, this is why, communists can't run economies because they don't understand that the economy is way too complicated to sort of micromanage. But anyway, Michael, any final thoughts on this before we close up for today?
No, I mean, other than to say, I absolutely agree with Terence that it's not as if there are three or four steps we can take and then guarantee that we'll have a capital inflow. But or indeed, as somebody's pointed out in the comments, that that local people will invest. I mean, there's lots of local capital that is not that is reluctant to participate in the economy for exactly the same reasons. I think it's really just clearing the route to opportunities is really what we're looking at, clearing the obstacles. And property rights obviously is a key one there. If people are going to feel that their fixed assets are potentially under threat, they're simply not going to invest in them. So that's yeah. So I do agree. It's a complex
Indeed. All right. That is all the time we have for today. Once again, I apologize if I was a bit sort of all over the place myself. I'm still recovering from that flu, but hopefully that'll be sooner rather than later. And I hope that everyone has a wonderful day. I will see you all tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.